From the latest hip hop beats to social issues that cripple the black community, all from the perspective of a young, strong black woman.
A strong black woman.
And now your host, Rita.
Welcome back, everyone, for another episode of According to RP on WJMS Radio, powered by Black Ivy Media. It's your girl, Rita Pierre, your host, and as always, I hope you guys are striving, thriving, and surviving in these corona-infested streets. So, last Sunday of the month, guys, like, May is over. Memorial Day is tomorrow, which kind of sucks. I don't know about you guys, but at least for those of us living in the Northeast, Memorial weekend sucks. It is not sunny. It was raining all day, cats and dogs, in New York City, at least from Friday afternoon. And I checked the weather for tomorrow. It's going to be sunny, partly cloudy, but it's going to be like what? Like high 60s. I don't even know if it's going to touch the 70s. So everybody knows that at least up here in the Northeast, Memorial Day is really what marks the first day of summer. And so far, the first day of summer sucks. And I really, really hope that June is not one of those rainy months. I don't know, for those of you who remember, June 2009, it rained every single day except for one day. And I literally counted. So I'm really hoping that this June is not going to be a rainy, chilly June. Like, I am looking for summer. And I know a lot of you, especially those of you who ran out and got vaccinated, are hoping for a hot girl, hot boy, no rain summer. And for your sakes, I hope that you get it. But I don't know. I'm not feeling optimistic. I'm really upset that I was cooped up in my home for practically the entire holiday weekend. I'm really hoping to get out a little bit tomorrow, but I mean, who wants to be out sitting on like a blanket in 60 something degree weather? I don't know. Anyways, I digress. I digress. So today is Haitian Mother's Day. I did mention this a couple of weeks ago when I was wishing all of you a regular Mother's Day. But you know, the Haitians, the Dominicans, we walk to the beat of our own drums and we have a separate Mother's Day. And so today, the last Sunday of May, marks Mother's Day for the Dominicans and the Haitians. So happy Mother's Day to all of the Haitians, first and foremost, and the Dominicans. So there were a lot of awarenesses in the month of May. And I feel like as the years are going by, like they're just piling on awarenesses and National Heritage Months. And so any given month, you'll have 20 things to celebrate. But May has always been the month of mental health awareness. And I know a lot of people, especially with everything that's been going on lately, has truly been dedicated to that particular cause. I mean, a lot is going on in the world, and it's important for us to protect our mental health. And remember that we've learned that mental illness and mental health, although yes, same umbrella, everybody has mental health, not everybody has a mental illness. So it's important that we all address our mental health, that we protect our sanity, that we protect our energy. And I think over the course of this year and somewhat whatever months due to the pandemic, a lot of us were forced to do inner work. A lot of us were forced to really take inventory with who we are, take accountability for who we are and how we project to others. We were able to reflect more and really determine, I think, what we want to present, right, to the world, or how we want to present to the world. So I am just asking that we all continue to to work on preserving our mental health. Let's continue to raise awareness about mental health on an everyday basis. We should not have to wait for the month of May to put on all these programs and to, you know, have all these posts and to talk about promoting mental health awareness within our community, especially within the Black and Brown community. So I really do encourage you guys to really take it seriously. You know, yes, we're starting to, you know, come out of the pandemic. We are still in La Covida Maria, but we are slowly, at least I'm hoping, you know, shifting in a more positive direction, shifting in a better direction. But there's still a lot of aftermath with the pandemic. There's still a lot of current action happening with the pandemic. People's lives are still affected, job wise, you know, health wise. Even though many have overcome the virus, they're left with lasting issues. Family members are still mourning their loved ones, right? Senseless shootings are still going on each and every day in these streets, right? Young people are dying every single day. There's still a lot of stuff that is causing, you know, mental anguish, right? I mean, healthcare disparities, like there's so many things, housing, right? It's so much. And I think everybody at some point in some way, shape or form has been or currently is being affected in a way that could, you know, aggravate and could really cause damage and cause concern to one's mental health. So we really just want to make sure we keep that at the forefront. We keep our fingers on the pulse and that we continue to talk about mental health and that we continue to raise awareness and that we continue to lobby, to petition and to work with our local organizations and politicians and whatnot to bring light to this issue as a serious issue and to demand that more is being done. I would say particularly for our homeless population that's roaming the streets right now, right? There's a lot of issues that are taking place in our communities that are unfortunately happening at the hands of the homeless people, but it's a cyclical thing, right? We need to be able to address those issues as well. And the mental illness that a lot of these individuals are experiencing, therefore causing them to, you know, act in ways that is increasing crime and whatnot. So it's a very big thing. It's something that affects everything, right? It's a cycle in a sense, but we have to get ahead of it. We have to get on it in order for us to truly move forward. If we're talking about safety, if we're talking about, you know, respect and dignity for the individuals living within our society. Whew, that was a lot, but necessary. So today, on today's episode, I'm going to talk about my COVID journey. Now, I know that in the last couple of episodes, I've talked a little bit about, you know, recently catching COVID and a little bit about what's been going on, but I've still failed, I would say, to really jump into the journey because I'm currently going through this journey, even as a post-COVID patient. And I think that this is information that people really need to understand and people really need to hear because a lot of us have recently gone through it, are currently going through issues post-COVID. We're experiencing a lot. And I think it's taking a toll on us, especially those of us who are in the working space, those of us who are in the creative space that cannot really afford to just sit back for like months on end and allow this thing to resolve within us. Also, I'm going to talk about a recent negative experience that I had at New York Presbyterian Brooklyn Methodist Hospital. I feel like the name of this hospital keeps getting longer and longer. But for those of you who are from New York, from Brooklyn, you know New York Methodist Hospital. And I am somebody who believes in calling things out because that's the only way that we're going to, you know, get accountability or at least, you know, attempt to demand accountability from these healthcare systems that are responsible for treating the general public. I mean, it's crazy to me that in 2021, Black women and really Black people in general, because if you guys remember an earlier episode about my brother's negative experience with this hospital, it's crazy that we are still being ignored and mistreated and just not really considered. So today I want to talk about the importance of self-advocacy in healthcare and the need for us people to educate ourselves on our rights and aligning ourselves with medical professionals that can assist in advocating for us when the time is needed. It is important for us to self-advocate and for us to empower ourselves with knowledge, but it's also important for each and every one of us to have a doctor within our Rolodex. One that is not your primary care doctor, but a doctor that can advocate and will advocate for you. So I'm going to get into that a little more in depth as we get into the meat of the show. But before we do that, you know, we have our preliminaries, so let's get into them. It is now time for the Urban Dictionary word or phrase of the week.
Do you understand the words that are coming out of my mouth?
May I have the definition?
What does skeet skeet mean?
What's on fleek?
Can you use it in a sentence?
I've been on fleek, lit.
And it's gonna be lit.
Major key.
It's time for the Urban Dictionary word or phrase of the week.
So this week's Urban Dictionary word or phrase of the week is, dun, da, da, da. You know, I like to have a little background music. Where the money resides. Now, I think I might have used this phrase a few times on this show because it's been the phrase, I don't know, of 2020 going into 2021. But for those of you who are hearing people use this phrase, where the money resides, and you're like, I'm still not quite sure what that means. Where the money resides, which of course has an abbreviation, WT$R, is from a guy named Darrell Smiley, who is from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. He's a car salesman who went viral after posting a video that details a special to customers looking into purchasing a new vehicle. He made up where the money reside in that video. It basically means this is where the money is at. Example, me. Hey, Chris, where you at? Chris says, where the money reside, where the money reside. So yeah, that is, that's where all that came from. I know some people have heard the saying, but again, didn't know where the origin was. But I remember seeing this car commercial going viral on social media with this individual by the name of Darrell doing his little dance for his commercial and saying where the money reside. And ever since then, I feel like I've tried to find a way to use this phrase in everyday common, you know, common language, right? Another phrase that he didn't coin this, but I guess he's coined the use of it, is, and that's on Mary Had a Little Lamb. So instead of saying, you know, and that's on that or period, you know, he has this saying, you know, and that's on what? Mary Had a Little Lamb. And I've actually been using that. And I've actually been creating my own, and that's on, you know, rice and beans or whatever it is. Like, I found other creative ways to kind of, you know, remix the actual phrase. It just goes to show our creativity, right? I think that that was the joke and that was the relief that a lot of us needed during the pandemic, because I know that a lot of people were sharing that video and found it to be very humorous and has adopted, you know, his phrases into our everyday language. But that's where it is, where the money reside. I know that's clearly where I want to be. And if anybody knows where the money resides legally, you can definitely send a DM to According to RP and I will find a way to be there. But that is our word or phrase of the week from the Urban Dictionary. So next we have our Haitian Creole word or phrase of the week. So this week's Creole, Haitian Creole word or phrase of the week is wap kon jouj. Wap kon jouj. So wap kon jouj literally translates to you will know George. The phrase is basically the equivalent of saying, okay, keep playing. You're going to see soon. You'll know soon enough. You'll see, or you got another thing coming. I wanted to step things up just a little bit this month, with some of these words and kind of just, you know, divert briefly from the, you know, hi, my name is, and, you know, I want to go to the bathroom or whatever. Although those are very important phrases for you to learn. They're the basic survivals. But I think it's cool sometimes to kind of add in some of these more complex yet everyday phrases that we might have, you know, we might hear in the streets, especially those living in Caribbean infested areas where the Haitians reside. A lot of you guys grew up hearing, you know, all these complex phrases and really didn't know exactly what the hell is going on. And wap kon jouj is one of them. In fact, as a Haitian American, I was often met with this phrase. And the biggest question for me, as I'm sure a lot of you who grew up with it or around it, was who the hell is George? And when and why do I have to meet him? It was always a thing that my mom, you know, if I did something, oh, wap kon jouj. Well, it's like, who is George? Who is George? And why exactly do I need to meet him? Is he my long lost father? Like, why is George's name being brought up in this particular incident? And it's usually when I have done something that's questionable, that was wrong. This is when George's name was evoked. And the mystery continues for many of us in terms of who is George and why does he need to meet us? Why do we need to meet him? Right, we're still waiting. Haitians around the world are still waiting to meet George. And it's crazy because some of us who have, you know, adopted the Haitian culture with our own children, our children are wondering who is George. And, you know, with the kids these days, they're not like us. Like, they're much more inquisitive and they're asking these questions. And then they're even questioning us as to whether George even exists. So it's like with every generation, the George mystery is getting, like, you know, is slowly being chipped away. At some point, I don't know if it's going to be 20, you know, 30, 20, 40, that the kids are going to just be like, just the jig is up. There is no George. We've documented in history there is no George. Stop talking about George. Find another threat. So since it's still Haitian Heritage Month, we got 2 days left. You know, I definitely wanted to kind of talk about this a little bit because this is a big part of Haitian history and of Haitian culture. And especially those of us, again, living in Haitian communities, whether you're Haitian or not, you've been met with this wap kon jouj business. I mean, people are capitalizing on it, making T-shirts with it. Like, it's part of the culture and we still need answers. And as I'm talking about it being I know I'm bouncing around here, but Haitian Heritage Month still. For those of you who don't know, Brooklyn Academy of Music, BAM, for those of us who live in Brooklyn, they have their annual Dance Africa Festival. It's a film festival. It's currently going on. It's happening virtual this year. And there are going to be many Haitian films showcased for free. That's right. Free 99. Okay, free 99. Haitian history is Black history. It's the world history. And it's not because I'm Haitian and I'm a proud Haitian that I'm saying that, but it's literally the truth. The Haitian Revolution, right, is, I would say, you know, one of them. And so there is a film on Toussaint Louverture that's going on right now as well, too, I think until June 2nd. So you guys definitely want to take advantage of this. Make it a family night. Make it a date night, or make it a personal night, right? For your personal edification, take advantage of these free films that are being showcased at BAM on BAM.org. You definitely want to be part of it. I love Dance Africa. I hate the fact that I'm not able to be out there in these streets for a second year because of the Rona, but they are having virtual events, and I would really, really, encourage you guys to participate. Be part of the culture, right? That's one step in changing the narrative. Changing the narrative is by taking the time to educate ourselves as to who we are as a Black people, as to where we come from, as a diaspora, whether you were born Haitian or not, but to understand what the struggle was about and how Haitians have essentially led to all Black people from around the world to obtain their freedom. These things are important as we're talking about moving forward. We're talking about revolution. We're talking about unity. We're talking about collectivity, Black generational wealth. Like, we have to begin to break down the silos amongst ourselves as a Black diaspora. And the way to do that is to learn about each other, to understand why maybe Haitians are so proud, to understand why, you know, Haiti is where it's at. The sacrifices that we've had to make as a country because of our audacity to obtain freedom, not just for the enslaved Africans that were in Haiti, but the fact that we led a revolt around the world and we assisted and we inspired slave rebellions all throughout the entire world. Right? These are things that are important. And sometimes we have to put ourselves aside to really allow ourselves to truly be educated by history so that we could start to move forward. So that's why I think that things like the programs that BAM, produce in general, but especially around Dance Africa, when they're focusing on the African diaspora, it is important that we not just, you know, hear about it and we go buy, you know, some earrings at the flea market when they do it every year, but that we actually watch these films. We actually support these platforms that are trying to do its best to change the narrative, to change the way that Blacks are portrayed, not just here in America, but around the world. So as that was a long deviation from the Haitian Creole word or phrase of the week, but again, it is WAP, like, you know, WAP, like Cardi B's WAP, con Josh. And if there's somebody out there, I know my Haitian historians, if you are out here and you're listening to this and you have a little more context as to why it was Georges and not Gustave or Julien or Jacques or even Jean. I mean, Jean is the quintessential Haitian. Why isn't it Wap Kon Jean? What is it about George? I have reason to believe that George has something to do with Great Britain, as everybody knows, or maybe you guys don't know. I keep forgetting that. I'm a student of history. I love history, so I love learning about these things. But even Britain had some sort of occupational time in Haiti, right? And so Haiti is a very rich country. I know that most people know it for being, you know, a French-based country, and that the official language is French, but that we speak Haitian Creole and that we share an island with Dominican Republic. So there's Spanish influences, but there are so many different influences in Haiti. There was a big Filipino presence. And I think the Filipinos might still be there because my grandmother would talk about the Filipinos and we had friends who were Haitian Filipino. The Arabs, there's a heavy Lebanese, Syrian presence in Haiti even till this day. The Polish have a presence in Haiti even till this day. So there's so many different influences. And so there was an English influence as well, too, because there are some of our words like memem tu, too is also, right? So it's me saying me also when I say moi-même too. There's a lot of English words that kind of stuck and found its way in our language because of the different periods of occupation that, you know, these European nations had on Haiti. And I'm wondering if George is from King George. I wonder when they say Wapkon George, if they are talking about King George from Great Britain. I don't know. So if you are a Haitian historian out there, I mean, I guess I could do my own Google search, but I mean, why go through that extra step when we have Haitian historians among us? Slide up in the DM. According to RP on Instagram, if you're not on Instagram, you can send an email at accordingtorp@gmail.com. And let's get to the bottom of this. Let's not let 2021 go by without us learning the mystery of Wapkon George. So we are now on to one of my favorite sections of this show. It is now time for the big up of the week. Watch it. And you feel big up, big up. All of the woman them big up, big up. All of the girl them big up, big up. All of the woman them big up, big up. What? So I absolutely love graduation season because I love seeing our young people graduating from college, getting their degrees, graduating from high school, and really just taking their lives to another level. And so this big up of the week goes to a young woman by the name of Mariah Jones, a young Black woman who's 18 years old from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So according to the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, high school senior Mariah Jones went from living in a women's shelter with her family to now being on her way to the prestigious Vassar College on a full scholarship. She got a full ride to Vassar College. And for those of you who don't know, it is a very prestigious college. I've had friends who went there, and she's going to be studying astrophysics. Like, who does that, right? I don't know anybody studying astrophysics. Talk about Black girl magic. And so I just really want to congratulate this young woman, but also highlight her because her life is a testimony, I believe, for young women out here who are literally going through it. Again, you know, COVID obviously exacerbated a lot of issues, but even prior to that, these social issues were present. Homelessness, right? Housing crisis. Like, these are all things that were present even before. And we have a lot of young women who are growing up in these conditions who are now, you know, like, they're wondering, well, can I go to college? Can I pursue higher education? Is it possible for a girl living like me in the projects, or a girl living in a broken home, or a young girl who's living in even a two-parent home that's going through challenges? Like, am I able to overcome, persevere, and make something out of myself? And so I think it's important when we highlight these particular stories that we are, in a sense, inspiring young women, and I would even dare say young men, right? Young men, to basically, you know, to see that this is something that can be done. And I think that these stories need to be shared. Young Black girls from around the world need to see and need to hear about other young Black girls in their positions, overcoming, rising above, but most importantly, not allowing their current situation to define and dictate their future. I think that is the biggest lesson that needs to be highlighted, is that no matter where you are in life, whether it's living in a homeless shelter, living in a women's shelter, having no place to stay. I mean, we've had stories of young professionals living in their cars and going to school and graduating. You know, we need to continue to highlight these positive moments where people in current dire situations are still rising above and not letting their situations define and dictate their future. So that is important. So big up to this young queen, Mariah Jones, 18 of Pittsburgh. I really do look forward to the amazing breakthroughs that this astrophysician is going to accomplish in her time. So now we are on to the womp womp of the week, because you guys know with every high, there is always a low. And this society, I tell you, sometimes you have to sit back and you have to wonder, how much lower are we going to go as a society, as a world, right? It really baffles me the level of ignorance, the level of just tone deafness that is occurring in the 21st century, particularly in 2021, when we're in this age of internet, age of social media, meaning everybody knows what's going on. It's not like back in the day where they were lynching people and all these, you know, atrocities, these racist atrocities were taking place, these egregiousness was happening, and nobody knew. Like, there wasn't information sharing. And so, you know, we can say that, oh, maybe these people don't know what racism looks like, or they let this happen because they weren't fully aware. I feel like we are past this era of ignorance. Thank you, internet. But somehow we're still trapped in the dark ages. Like, it doesn't make any sense. So what am I talking about? Well, for those of you who keep your noses in the internets like I do, according to the Washington Post, Spain's postal service has introduced skin tone stamps to fight racism and makes the whitest one the most valuable. So the Spain, you know, postal system, they're trying to fight racism, right? They're wanting to jump on this bandwagon of everybody talking about racism and wanting to, you know, get to the root. And to really be part of the change, right? That's what we're seeing, this theme. We want to change the narrative. We want to help change the narrative. But instead, they essentially, I think, made things worse. And their attempt, and I'm putting that in air quotes because I really don't know what the real motive was here, but in their attempt to do better, they're actually doing worse. So this is kind of another episode of who let this, you know, prototype, who let this sample out of the strategy meeting room. So the stamps come in four tones. There's white, like, you know, the very, very pale peach colored crayon. For those of you who are, you know, owners of these 64, 120, whatever crayon boxes as a kid, there's like that very pale, pale peach crayon. And then there's kind of like a tan color stamp. And then there's a medium brown, I would say like a rich brown stamp. And then there's black, like literally the color black, right? Again, another faux pas, because I haven't actually seen anybody, even in National Geographic magazine, which I was obsessed with, never seen anybody the color of black, but I digress. So they have these four stamps. The whitest tone is worth, 1.60 euros. So I don't know. They don't call it $1.60, but, you know, 1.60 euros, right? I guess $1.60 if that makes sense. I'm not really sure how they I guess 1 euro and 60 cents. There we go. Bam. 1 euro and 60 cents. The second whitest tone is 1 euro and 50 cents. The medium brown euro definitely declines. Like, I don't know what this is, but 80 cents, right? And the darkest of them all is only worth 70 cents. So, of course, this has promoted widespread outrage and criticism around the world, around the global community. The world is scoffing at Spain for this egregious faux pas. It's an egregious faux pas. If I were them, if you want to pay tribute or you want to help, you know, stop racism, find a couple of characters, some heroic characters, you know, Spanish characters, right? Heroes, historians, whatever, and just put them on the stamp. Like how, you know, I think we're still trying to get Harriet Tubman or whatever. Like, just create a stamp with one of your forefathers who were of African descent or something, and just recognize them. But they really tried to go down this path, the spectrum, this color coding spectrum, and assigned worth to each tone, making the whitest tone €1.60, and then the black one 70 cents. Like, look at the devaluation, right? So now, one of the representatives of this of the stamp company, right, basically came out to explain that the darker the stamp, the less value it will have, which means that when you're making a shipment, you will have to use more black stamps than white stamps on each letter in the shipment. So therefore, it's going to be a reflection. Each time you get a letter, it's going to be a reflection of the inequality created by racism. So you get a letter, like, let's say it's a little heavy, you got like five black stamps on it, you're going to know that this is oppression because they had to use more black stamps to make up, you know, the fee, as opposed to if they had purchased one white stamp. It just doesn't make sense to me. And this is what you call ass backwards, right? The stamp was created to fight racism, but instead it ends up further perpetrating racism in such an overt and egregious manner. Because this is overt. There's nothing sneaky and behind the scenes about this. Like, this is in your face racism. And it's really, really hard for me to believe that individuals in this new era can be this tone deaf and essentially dumb. A part of me honestly believes that these are intentional acts, that there really was not an agenda to fight racism, but to really find a way to further perpetuate it, and then to, like, you know, hide in ignorance and hide in, oh my gosh, like, I was not aware, this was not our agenda, this was not our intention. But it's a little hard for me to believe in this case how you think that assigning the, you know, the most worth to the white stamp and assigning the least value to the black stamp was going to help fight racism. It doesn't make sense to me. So the womp womp of the week goes to you, Spain, and your postal company, your postal agency. Whew. So a lot going on in the news. And there's so much more, guys. We just don't have that much time to address everything. But we are now moving on to the meat of the show. Like I had referenced earlier in this, in the show, today I'm going to be talking about my COVID journey and also my recent negative experience with New York Presbyterian Brooklyn Methodist Hospital in Brooklyn, New York. So many of you were not aware that I had recently had gone through a bout of COVID, and it was a little hard for me to, like, really fully dive into, you know, what actually happened. Like, I know that I talked about it a little bit, but, you know, it's something that's still fresh for me, and I think I was still trying to figure out how I really wanted to address this issue, how I wanted to talk about it without sounding, you know, so bitter and angry. But really trying to talk about it in a way that would be beneficial for others who have gone through it and are currently going through it, and unfortunately will possibly go through it, right? Because COVID is still real. It's still in these streets. It's still lurking, popping and locking with the best of us, right? So late in April, like the last week in April, I ended up contracting COVID. And I got it in the most, for me, in the weirdest way, right? Because I am somebody who takes a lot of precaution. When I go out, I have my masks. I make sure that I really don't hang with people that I know are for the streets and are in the streets, because that's how people are catching COVID, right? People who are, like, constantly in the streets, like, they don't know who they're with. They, you know, they have their guard down, they're walking around maskless, and they think they're invincible because they probably have caught it and they think that they have immunity. There's all these, you know, misconceptions and misunderstandings about how people are catching COVID and spreading it in these streets.
But I tend to not hang out with people who I know have a reputation to just always be in the mix during these times. But either way, one of my, you know, friends had a birthday get together, and they do say that that is how people are actually catching it. It's the intimate gatherings. It's not being outside. Like, it's not going to the park. It's not going to the supermarket. It's being in intimate gatherings. People catching it at their doctor's offices. People catching at, you know, family dinners. And so, you know, my friend had her birthday. I hadn't really been around people since my grandmother's funeral in a very relaxed setting. And I'm like, man, I got invited, you know, because I woke up that morning and Facebook alerted me that it was her birthday. And so, of course, I say happy birthday, and that happy birthday ended up getting me invited to this small intimate gathering. And this individual had a safety plan, a safety protocol. Everyone had to be tested. And after you were tested, you weren't to be in the streets, right? Making sure that you didn't negate this negative test. And so under those circumstances, I felt very comfortable because I knew some of the individuals who would be there have asthma, have serious conditions. And so, you know, their protection was definitely at the forefront. And so I felt comfortable going. And so I did. And it wasn't a lot of people. It wasn't like a 20-person party. Like, at any given time, there was only a handful of people there because there were people who came and there were people who left. So I went, you know, I took my mask off because we were all supposed to be negative, and it was said that you had to be. And I was comfortable, and I was happy, actually, because I was able to get out the house and really communicate with other people in a very comfortable setting. Unfortunately, one of the individuals who showed up at this party, again, the story was always back and forth, but one of the individuals apparently just showed up and had not provided, you know, the information that was necessary to really give her clearance to be there. And of course, it was that one individual who had the Rona, but because she was, I guess, at the time, seemingly asymptomatic, because I think that she might have been coughing the week before, so not really asymptomatic, but you know, felt fine. It wasn't questioned. There was no like, oh, should I be here? Should I not be here? And it was a great time. I'm not going to sit here and lie and say that it wasn't. It was a great time. However, this individual brought in the Rona and affected 5 people at the party. And out of everybody who ended up getting it, I got it the worst, and I'm still dealing with it. And for me, it was a very bitter moment when I realized that I actually had the Rona, because, you know, prior to me feeling the symptoms, like I started coughing like maybe 2 days later. It worked really, really fast with me. But before that, even though I had known that there was an exposure, I was still actually okay, because in my mind, I'm playing it out. I'm like, okay, maybe she got it at the end stage and therefore she was no longer shedding, and therefore she couldn't really pass it to us because she was, you know, on her mend since she was feeling fine and she didn't know when she actually caught it. So I'm thinking, you know, we're all going to be fine. So, you know, still communicating with these individuals, still really trying to get to the bottom of things. But then I started coughing. And then the day after, I started getting the fevers, the body aches, the breathing issues, like the whole nine. And then I started feeling a little better. So then I thought I was on a mend, and I'm like, oh, this is going to be fine. Like, this is not going to be anything crazy. I'm drinking my Haitian remedies. I'm taking Jamaican stuff. I'm taking stuff from all over the African diaspora. I'm going to be fine. It's just going to be a really bad cold, because I know people who've gotten it and they were like, they just got the sniffles and that's it. So I had mustered enough energy to do my sexual assault awareness event that I was so proud to do through the Black Ivy Media channel. I hosted it. I was part of the discussion. And then the next day went totally downhill to the point where I was told, I need to go to the hospital. I need to go to the hospital now. But I refused to go, not because, you know, I'm one of those people, but because it's very scary. I have lost a lot of people during this pandemic. Relatives, blood relatives, uncles, cousins. I've lost friends. I've lost a lot of people, like, dead during this COVID experience for over the last year and a half. And unfortunately, you know, people are still dropping. And the one thing is that, you know, was like a link with a lot of them is the ones who went to the hospitals were the ones who didn't come back home. And so here I am being told I need to go to the hospital now. And I'm refusing because I'm like, I don't know what's happening over there, but I don't want to be part of that number. So I was doing my best to fight with my symptoms at home. Like I had people dropping off all these interesting concoctions, all these different things. I was sitting here remembering, what would your grandmother do, Rita? What, how did she bring down fevers naturally? How did she? So I was thinking about all sorts of things to do at home. And at some point I did have a threshold where I was like, if this does not get better by this time, by an hour, I'm going to have to bite the bullet. It was really bad. And then it was still getting worse. And then finally it started to get a little better, but then I started developing new symptoms. As I thought I was getting out of the woods a little bit, now I can't breathe. So I have no more fevers. I can no longer breathe deeply. And now I'm having this weird sense of smell where I can smell, but I have an after smell that smells like death, that smells like sickness. There's no way for me to explain it, but I have a constant after smell that I could only equate it to sickness because it doesn't smell like anything, but it smells like, I don't know, maybe a hospital. I don't know. And then I started having, you know, chest pains, pressure, chest burning that was just randomly happening. Now, 2 weeks after finally testing negative, because I was testing positive for 3.5 weeks and I was sick for 3.5 weeks, I started feeling better and I started testing negative. And then while I'm during this post-COVID period, I am back to getting chest pains. The cough has come back with a vengeance. I'm having chest burnings. I'm having this pressure. At night, I'm gasping for air. Like I've made several emergency room trips and it's been crazy. It's like the moment you think you're doing okay, you do a little bit and then you're back, you know, to ground zero almost. You're knocked off your horse. So this experience has been a journey. Like, and I think that trying to not hold on to the bitterness of how I got it. Like if I had caught COVID at my grandmother's funeral, or if I had caught it in the street or even a doctor's office, I would still be upset. I would still be hurt, I think, and I would still be like distressed about it, but I wouldn't be as angry as I was because I caught it at someone's house that established protocols and essentially broke their own protocol. Like had they been on top of things, I would not have gotten sick. Had they have said, hey, this is a party, come as you are, come if you want, and I went anyways, and I took off my mask despite, then I could say, okay, this is my fault. But because of the circumstances, it made it very difficult for me to just grasp, right? And so being angry, being upset, being annoyed, and then trying to heal at the same time has been very, very challenging because it's hard to really let go of these things, right? When you're still not able to breathe at times, when you still can randomly wake up with chest pains, it's hard when you are going through all of these issues and you have no choice but to go to an urgent care because you don't know what's going on. And they tell you that you need to rush to the hospital because it might be a pulmonary embolism that is quite common in, you know, patients who currently have COVID and post-COVID patients. So this is like a constant scary threat, right? So it's been what is going to be going on 6 weeks, right? And I'm still having these residual issues. I still have to take extra effort to take a deep breath. I still have random issues going on. I still have to leave my house every day with my oximeter to make sure I'm monitoring my oxygen, monitoring my heart rate. I have to do these deep breathing exercises 5 times a day to make sure that I'm expanding my lung so that I can, you know, get back the function and be able to breathe deeply again and not be so out of breath. And so it's a little difficult, you know, to really just navigate with all of this. And I think what the scary part is that I've been told that this could be a longer process. It could be even up to a 6-month process because there are people that have said that it took them months to be able to breathe normally and to kind of get back to normal. So it's a very scary thing. And I've always said from the beginning, COVID is real, you know, although a lot of us are walking around acting like it's not. Just because somebody you know caught it and just got a sniffle and just got a little cough doesn't mean that the next person is going to end up like that. And so we all have to be responsible for each other. We all have to be mindful. We all have to know if you are somebody who's in these streets, you can't just be showing up at people's functions, showing up at people's houses. Like if you are an anti-vasker and an anti-masker, like you need to keep yourself away because you're putting people's lives at risk. And a lot of people are taking this very nonchalant, casual, it's not my fault, but it kind of is your fault if you are out here in these streets not protecting yourself and are then wanting to go into intimate settings with people who are protecting themselves. Like you're putting people at risk because you just want to be everywhere and in the mix. And that's not cool. That's not safe, right? So in the time that I have left, I do want to just talk about the recent hospital experience and why it is important to self-advocate and to identify a doctor, an internal medicine doctor, or somebody within the a specialty, family doctor, somebody that can advocate for you, somebody who's outside of your primary care network. And I'll explain why that's important. So this past Wednesday, I ended up in the emergency room again. So few days prior, I have been experiencing some severe symptoms, chest burning, chest pressure, chest pain, gasping for air. The cough had come back with a vengeance. And I was monitoring this, you know, as the days were going by to see what's going on. There were certain points of the day I was doing good. And then there were other points of the day that I wasn't doing good. It's very weird. Like I could have had a conversation with someone and I would have been, you know, still sounding eh, but not like I'm about to die. But then hours later, it was a different scenario. So by the third night of not being able to sleep and experiencing these symptoms, I said, you know what? I need to go to the urgent care. So I went in there thinking that, hey, maybe they might see that I have some sort of like respiratory infection. Maybe that's what's causing all of this. And they'll give me some antibiotics because I know COVID pneumonia is a thing and I'll be on my merry way. But when I went in there, they did an EKG. Something was funny about the EKG. And because of my post-COVID status of only being 2 weeks, you know, negative, and having these increased symptoms that were worsening, they were concerned based on what they have seen as physicians dealing, you know, with COVID patients, individuals getting pulmonary embolisms. And so they took my situation very, very seriously. And in fact, they, you know, they saw my hesitancy to go to the hospital. So they had to really like tell me, this is a life and death situation. You need to make sure that you're not going to go home and die. So at that point, I'm like, I need to go to the emergency room. And so I was close to the Coney Island Hospital at that time, ironically enough, but decided to go all the way to New York Methodist because that's the hospital that I'm typically used to. I delivered my son there. You know, I have people who work there. I was always comfortable with it, even despite them having, you know, issues and them being on a decline, in my opinion, and in the opinions of people who actually work there, when it comes down to patient care. If you guys remember my episode a couple of episodes ago with my younger brother, who had a very negative experience with New York Methodist, in which he went in with internal bleeding. They fast tracked him. But once they realized his insurance wasn't that great, they sent him home and said, oh, just use softer toilet paper. He then got a black nurse in there, was like, listen, you can get Medicaid overnight, come back tomorrow. He did that. And the next day he ended up being fast tracked based on the symptoms, saw two surgeons and scheduled a surgery. So they knew that his situation was dire from day one, but because he didn't have insurance, they just found some stupid asinine thing to say like, oh, just wipe your butt a little softer and sent him home, knowing that he had been bleeding internally for a period of time. But then the next day, in 24 hours, you saw how the same hospital treated him differently because he had a little insurance. And next thing, he goes from being sent home and said, wipe your butt with a softer tissue paper, to being scheduled for surgery. Craziness. So again, New York Methodist has been, in my opinion, going on a decline when it comes to quality of care, particularly toward people of color. So now I go to the emergency room and I let them know exactly what's going on. I was told that with the state that I'm in, there's no, like, they're going to take me quickly. That, you know, they're going to do what they got to do. I saw them. I did a chest x-ray thinking that, okay, things are seemingly, you know, going fast. They're taking this seriously. It took them, like, I don't know, 30 minutes maybe to almost an hour to come collect my blood so that they can do blood work. I informed them exactly what was going on. I even gave them, you know, the CKG that I was sent with to show, like, you know, maybe what the little concern was about. I was told exactly that I needed to get this particular CT exam so that they could, you know, see whether or not there was a pulmonary embolism lodged somewhere in my chest. I explained everything to them. So, you know, even from me initially meeting them, looking like death, sounding like death, coughing like I was about to, like, take my last breath, the patient care was still not good. Even with the PA, which was a Black woman, she still was kind of on some weird, like, all right, here goes another person, like, just here to, you know, make me do work. That is the exact attitude that I got from everyone. Like, they didn't really want to take this seriously. So now I am met with this Asian doctor, Dr. Chen. He, you know, meets with me. He comes off, you know, nice. He's talking about what's, you know, going on, asking me questions. And I'm letting him know, like, exactly what's been happening, that I'm recently off of COVID. In fact, I had went to their emergency room from before. They had to put me on steroids, put me on meds to address the breathing issue at the time. So here I'm back with chest pains, with worsening conditions from the last time I was there. And he's like, they're going to do blood work. They're going to go over the blood work and then, you know, talk about the doing the further testing. While I'm there, no drugs have been administered to me. No IV was given to me. I was literally lying down, coughing my lungs up, complaining about the chest pain. No pain medications were given to me. Nothing. Right. I was there for 6 hours. It took forever for them to get the blood work back. I think maybe a couple of hours to get the blood work back and for them to get results back. So 6 hours I was there with no medication, no IV, no nothing. So then finally the PA comes. She talks to me and she says, oh, you know, the doctor is going to come talk to you soon. We got your blood work. So then the doctor comes in. And at the time, I didn't notice what his posture was. But now looking back, he came in to discourage me to get certain tests done. He came in and he spoke in a manner that, you know, would put me at ease to be like, all right, let me just go home. He had talked about a particular blood test that was administered to determine whether or not, I guess, there's clotting in my blood and what the likelihood of having a pulmonary embolism would be. So at that point, he was basically saying that, you know, there's no need to take the CT scan. But I know from based on talking to the prior two physicians that sent me there and speaking to other medical professionals subsequently, that it was necessary for me to have this exam because I'm not coming in as somebody who's just having chest pains. I'm coming in as an individual who was recently fresh off of COVID. And knowing that COVID complicates these things and that pulmonary embolisms have kind of been associated with COVID patients and my increased worsening, I guess, if that's the right way to put it together, of my symptoms out of, you know, kind of random, that these tests needed to be done to rule out that possibility. And I asked the doctor specifically if this blood test shows that, you know, things are normal. Does that mean that if I were to take a CT scan, that in no situation would you ever see a pulmonary embolism? And he said, that is correct. That, ladies and gentlemen, was a lie. It was not true because I confirmed it even with my primary care doctor, who's part of this network. She actually confirmed that that's not true. And I spoke to others who were not part of the network to just so I can get an overall opinion because I didn't want to get a CT scan because I do not like the contrast. I do not like being poked with this needle to get the dye through. Like, these are all, you know, exposures that I'm putting myself at risk to, that, you know, if it's not necessary to do, I would prefer not to. As somebody who does get CT scans a couple times a year for other issues, I don't want to, but I knew that I had to, because there's no way that I was going to leave this hospital without knowing for sure that everything was done to ensure that when I got home, I was going to wake up the next morning, or that when I left the building, I wasn't going to, you know, fall to the ground and die, because that's how serious pulmonary embolisms are. So after I spoke to the doctor, and he thought he convinced me to not move forward with the testing, I got on the phone with one of my cousins who's very high up there in the executive healthcare world. And she was like, you cannot go home. You need a full diagnostic checkup just based on your symptoms and based on your status as a post-COVID patient. It doesn't make sense. It's ridiculous that these hospitals are not wanting to do a comprehensive exam under these circumstances. She's like, you need to get that exam. I spoke to another doctor who's an emergency room doctor at another hospital, and they were like, you need to get this exam. So at this point, I go to the PA, and she's like, oh, we're going to discharge you. And I'm like, I don't think so. I think I need to move forward with the exam that I was sent here to take. I am not comfortable going home knowing that everything was not done to ensure that there is not a pulmonary embolism or something else that is blocking my breathing, that is causing these chest pains and the pressure and the burning in my chest. The doctor, the Asian doctor, happened to be there, and he automatically went from, you know, sweet to sour. The doctor that was trying to convince me to just go home was not the doctor that I met when I started advocating for myself. The moment that I started advocating for myself, that I started lifting up my voice and my concerns to say, listen, I am not comfortable. I have spoken to medical professionals that have confirmed that your assessment actually is not correct, and that based on my symptoms, based on my status, that I need to have this test. I am not comfortable being sent home without this test, and I would like to have this test done. From that moment, he became this condescending, uncaring doctor. He had like a 3-4 prong step to try to break me down. First, he says to me, well, there's radiation involved in the CT scan, and there's a 1% chance of getting cancer from the CT scan. Are you wanting to take that risk? He said that the risk of taking the CT scan and with that 1% chance of cancer far outweighed the risk of getting the test done to see if there was a pulmonary embolism. And so I'm like, if you're telling me that there's a 1% risk of chance that I might catch cancer from taking this test, and then there's another chance that I can walk out of here and die right out the building from a pulmonary embolism, I think it's a no-brainer. I think I should check to see if I have a pulmonary embolism. I've been taking CT scans for the better part of 15 years on various parts of my body, the brain, the heart, and I've never gotten cancer. So when he saw that that was not going to work on me, he then went on and said, well, you know, it could be post-COVID. It could be post-COVID complications. Yes, it could be. But the operative word is could be. You don't know. And there are tests that you can do to get a better level of certainty. When I said that, he's like, well, science, legit, like he literally said, well, science isn't certain. It's not 100% certain. So then when I'm like, I hear what you're saying, but you can then do this test to confirm the other test, that this blood work that you've done and whatever else that you've done, then you will have the full picture. Right now, you do not have the full picture. He then goes and says, well, I don't even know if we can justify ordering this test. I'm like, I was sent here from an urgent care. I didn't wake up this morning saying I want to come see you. I was sent here from an urgent care with urgent concerns. I've presented with the chest pains, the pressure, and all of these other symptoms that have been worsening since my post-COVID status. And you're telling me that you don't believe that the test I was sent here to do and I've been told to do, that, mind you, routinely happens in an emergency room. It just depends on what doctor you get, because I've went to emergency rooms where they've offered me spinal taps and I'm like, why? Right? So I don't think in this circumstance, your claim or this order would be denied and people would question you in the climate that we're in right now. He just did not want to do it. He was upset that I was challenging him. The moment that I opened my mouth to support and defend and advocate for myself, it became an issue. So now the PA comes to me, you know, and she's like, you know, I had to tell her, and I'm not the person who throws out the lawyer card, but I'm like, I'm an attorney and this is unacceptable. And I will be filing a formal complaint and I need the number to the risk management person on call. Once I started using those terms, she started trying to defend the doctor in a way that's like, listen, he's very thorough. Like, I've seen him. He usually goes through things thoroughly. Like, he's a really good doctor. And I'm like, but he's not being thorough right now. And she was trying to be like sympathetic with me as a Black woman. She understood where I was coming from and she said it. I understand. But at the end of the day, it's a fraternity up in there. And so she cannot go against what her attending is saying, right? And so they had called my primary care doctor, who had only seen once, mind you. So she actually doesn't really know my medical history. I had to switch and get a new doctor because of my insurance. I had gotten new insurance. And the same woman who said that the doctor was actually incorrect allegedly was like, well, you know, whatever the ED doctor says is what, you know, I guess should go. That's what they said, she said. And so therefore, on that, based on that, they said that they're not going to do the exam. Mind you, she's an internist, right? She didn't send me there. She didn't even know I was having these issues. She was not aware of the worsening condition. In fact, she has not seen me not once during my entire COVID situation. So now I speak to my cousin, who's like, you need to go to another hospital. You are not to go home. My mother was like, you are not to go home. So then she told me, go to Coney Island Hospital. So I went to Coney Island Hospital. And the moment I got there, it was a different experience. I was seen immediately. I was given treatment. Mind you, I told you they didn't give me any medication until I think at the last they gave me some like antacid pill or whatever at New York Methodist. As soon as I got to Coney Island, they administered, you know, my IV. They gave me steroids to help with the inflammation. They gave me some other treatments. I had several nebulizer treatments over the night to kind of help with the pressure and to help with the congestion and to help with the different things that was going on in my chest. They gave me some other medications that I can't remember, but things like I literally was on a treatment plan from the moment I got there to address the acute issue. They did the CT scan. They did the test that needed to be tested. And in looking in comparison to the blood work report that was done, they actually at Coney Island ordered tests that was specific to the complaints that I was making in terms of my breathing, the saturation, the carbon monoxide levels, so they could really see at what levels I was at. I took a look at the paperwork from New York Methodist. Not one of those 30 tests were ordered. Not one of those blood tests were administered. Crazy, because New York Methodist, this is a private hospital. And here we have a city hospital where people usually are kind of like tense and hesitant to go towards city hospitals because, you know, they're overcrowded and they believe that doctors are overworked and that the quality of care is poorer and that the wait time is longer. But I will tell you this, the experience that I had at Coney Island Hospital probably was one of the better experiences I've had in my life. And essentially, it's been a better experience than any that I've had at New York Methodist Hospital over the last couple of years. The medical professionals there were very caring and they understood, because pretty much every doctor that I've seen there had COVID and understood exactly what the concerns are and understood exactly what I was going through. So I don't know if nobody at New York Methodist never caught COVID and had no idea what was going on, but it was literally a day and night. And so when it comes to self-advocacy, it's something that we really need to take seriously because they are out here trying to kill us. These medical professionals and these healthcare facilities, the disparities and the inequalities are real. And it doesn't matter what your socioeconomic status is in most cases, what your education level is in most cases. When you show up to that emergency department, you show up black. They see black. They don't see Harvard on your forehead. They don't see six figures on your arm. They see a black person. And whatever judgments, whatever biases, whatever discriminatory, thoughts that they already have toward you as a black person, that is being played out in your quality of care plan. When Dr. Chen thought that I was just a sheep and that I was just going to sit here and listen to everything that he said, he was fine with me. Not a problem. The moment I opened my mouth, mind you, struggling to speak, so it's not like I was raising my voice and yelling. The moment I advocated for myself, he turned into a different person. He became condescending. He became uncaring. He became an asshole. And it was very disconcerting for me to see somebody else who's a part of the minority group to treat another like that. But again, we know that within the minority spectrum, that Asian doctors have been known to be very, very racist towards black people. And I feel like it's one of those things where as long as you don't challenge them, you're fine, they're fine. But the moment you start to advocate for yourself, it becomes an issue. The budget of the hospital is more important than your life. And that's essentially what he told me when he, at the end, his last, stabbing words were, I don't even know if we can justify this. He went through five other courses of arguments to try to get me to back down. And then the final one was, I don't even know if we can justify this. So you're saying that because of insurance reasons or because of monetary budget reasons, you don't know if this would be accepted. And so therefore you do not want the hospital to bear the burden. You don't want to be the physician, I guess, on file for ordering a quote unquote unnecessary test. But however, it is a necessary test based on the symptoms that I've presented with in the history. So the racism is real. The discrimination is real. It happened to my brother. It happened to me. It happens to black people every single day. Serena Williams, Beyonce, like celebrity status almost does not shield you from this type of, of discrimination and bias that are experienced in these hospitals. So you have to advocate for yourself. And sometimes the advocacy might not go as far as you need it to go in the current facility, but that's when you have to go somewhere else. I advocated for myself at New York Methodist Hospital, and it did not land where it needed to land. And so I had to continue advocating for myself in another facility where I was finally able to actually get the help that I needed. And it wasn't even just with that CT scan. It was the help that I needed. Because since coming back from Coney Island, I have not had not one chest pain, not one chest pressure, not one stabbing feeling in my chest. And my breathing, although I still cannot breathe deeply, I am not gasping for air at any given moment. Things have been better. They've identified issues that the other hospital didn't even identify because of their failure to test me properly, failure to administer certain things. I'm home now with medications and I'm doing much better. But along with self-advocacy, you have to find a medical professional, a doctor, I would say, that can advocate for you as well. A doctor or somebody who's high up in that, that healthcare executive world. It's so sad that that's the lengths that we have to go through to survive and to save our lives, but you have to have that. And here's why. Because when you, even if you are empowered with information and you are empowered with knowing your rights, these doctors, these medical professionals will still look down upon you and act as if you don't know what you're talking about and will not do what needs to be done. They will not give you the proper quality of care. But when you have another doctor, another person, board certified, whatever, who was part of that world, there is a shift when it comes to the advocacy. There is a shift. And again, you might not get what you need at that facility. You might have to leave to go somewhere else like I did, but you will be able to get the quality treatment that you deserve, you know, at this other facility under the guidance of this medical professional, right? Of this external advocate. And I say that this medical professional has to be somebody, I would prefer it to be a doctor or somebody who's higher up in the executive chain. And it should not be your primary care. Yes, you should consult your primary care anyways, but you should have somebody who's independent, because in the event that your primary care doctor is affiliated with that hospital network in which the emergency room doctors and professionals are taking a stance, 9 times out of 10, your primary care internist will side with their colleagues in that hospital network, therefore keeping you from getting the quality of care that you truly deserve. So, you know, according to the National Center of Biotechnology Information, there was an article that was released, Understanding Racial and Ethnic Differences in Health in Late Life. And they talk about different factors that end up really contributing to the healthcare disparities within the healthcare system. Insurance coverage, Blacks, Hispanics, and some of the Asian population, because not all, when compared with whites, appear to have lower levels of health insurance coverage. This situation creates a barrier for them to receive proper health care, as what happened to my brother. He did not have what they deemed to be proper health care, and although knowing that his situation was critical, sent him home. Essentially, he could have died. Their quality of care is definitely affected by systemic racism. We know this. In the kind of quality of medical care received by medical beneficiaries is crazy. It said that in 1992, Black Medicare beneficiaries were less likely than their white counterparts to receive any of the 16 most commonly performed hospital procedures. Stereotyping by providers. And I think this is the biggest one. Right? Some differences in medical care may be due to stereotype differences between groups held by healthcare professionals. And the author of Unequal Treatment, Institute of Medicine, published in 2002, argued that unconscious or unthinking discrimination based on negative stereotypes, even in the absence of conscious prejudice, may contribute to systemic bias in healthcare. And we know that to be true. The possibility that some healthcare providers may hold particular stereotypes is suggested by a few studies in which physicians were found to view their Black patients more negatively than the white patients. This is a problem, and this is what we are up against. Again, it doesn't matter your education level, how much money you make. You show up and you show up Black. And a lot of times, some of these professionals, they see you as Black. They view you as negative. They view you as you can take this pain. They view you as wasting their time. And they treat you accordingly, even in situations where you have life-threatening issues. So what can be done? Bias training, possibly? I don't know. Is that enough, right? I think what we really need to focus on is how do we self-advocate? How do we self-advocate properly? How do we educate ourselves about the healthcare system, what our rights and responsibilities are? How do we recreate coalitions of support, maybe even within hospitals, that can advocate? So when the doctor comes in and says, oh, you don't need this test when you clearly do, that there is a support group independent of the healthcare system within these hospitals, maybe made up of ethicists and medical professionals, again, outside of this healthcare system, that can review independently the case and help us advocate, help our voices be heard in situations that are life and death. How many more times do we need to hear about Black people going to the emergency room and being sent home with nothing only to die? And then going back and saying, man, if we did that test, we would have seen this. Man, if we administered those meds, we could have saved her life. It's crazy to me that in 2021, we are going through all of this. And if we don't take hold of our health, if we don't advocate for ourselves, if we don't do what we need to do to save our lives, we are going to lose our lives at the hands of these medical professionals. Now, it's not to say that it's everyone. I come from a long family of doctors, nurses, and other, you know, healthcare executives. But even with those individuals, they are not blind to the disparities and inequities within our healthcare system, within our American healthcare system. They are not blind to it. They have seen the injustice. They have witnessed these situations take place, and they acknowledge that something has to be changed. And so it's up to us when we are the victims of this type of poor treatment, when we are not receiving the quality care that we deserve, we need to speak up. We need to file these complaints, not just talk about, oh, I'm going to sue them, or, oh, I'm going to, you know, call the hospital or lodge a complaint. We need to actually do it. We need to start reporting these doctors. We can report them to the medical board. We can report them on healthgrades.com. There are websites dedicated to this. We can lobby, we can write letters. We have to hold these hospitals and these medical professionals accountable for the way that they are treating us. Hospitals are supposed to treat the sick, regardless of your creed, regardless of your race, your socioeconomic status. They're supposed to do that. That is the oath that they took. The Hippocratic oath that they took was to ensure that they treat everyone as they need to be treated, that they do no harm. I mean, there's the four pillars of bioethics that's involved when it comes to, you know, medical ethics. Beneficence, to act in the patient's best interest. Non-maleficence, to do no harm. Justice, to treat everyone equally. For example, distributing healthcare resources in a way that is fair to all. Autonomy, to respect the patient's choice. And that was not done. These pillars were not met during my hospital stay at New York Methodist under the care of Dr. Chen. It was not. And it's not being met under the care of thousands and thousands of Black and Brown people across this country on a daily basis. So we need to arm ourselves with not just information, but with advocates, with doctors, with medical professionals that can advocate for us, that can help us advocate. We need to figure out how do we chip away at these inequities and at these disparities, because if we don't do it, we are going to die. And we are going to die from preventable illnesses, from preventable circumstances, preventable situations. We're not going to be dying from, you know, out of nowhere situations, or like, oh my gosh, she had a heart attack or whatever. We are dying from preventable conditions, things that simple tests could identify and allow us to get treatment for. But because there's this bias, because there's this discrimination and racism that is so pervasive within our healthcare systems, the fact that these medical professionals are doing their best to minimize our concerns, to ignore our concerns, and to diminish what we're going through, it's difficult, but we have to stand the course. I was so close to just saying, I'm going to go home. I can't take this anymore. Like, I've been in the hospital for like 7 hours. I can't do another stay. But I had to think about my life. I don't know what's going on. And I did not leave there, and I would not be leaving there with any type of certainty, to be honest. So I had to do what I had to do. And thank God that I had, you know, my cousin, and I had other professionals that were there to really give me that empowerment and to give me that encouragement and to really, you know, allow me to feel like I'm not going crazy here. Like, I'm not asking for too much. I'm asking to give me a chance at life. Like, if I go home, am I going to be okay under these circumstances? Right. So we need to do better for ourselves, and we need to really start figuring out how to put certain mechanisms in place to save our lives, to save Black and Brown lives from the inequities and the disparities and all of this extraness that's going on in the healthcare facilities. So I hope that this talk was, you know, insightful. I hope that it was empowering for you. I hope that, you know, you take what I'm saying to heart and that you apply it and that you become your advocate moving forward. So with that being said, everyone, thank you so much for tuning into another episode of According to RP on WJMS Radio, powered by Black Ivy Media. It's your girl, Rita Pierre, your host. And as always, I will talk to you guys next week.
You were listening to According to RP on WJMS Radio.
About time you tuned in.
Tune in each and every Sunday.
I can't wait to come back.
7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
It's all online.